Nice. Well, thanks. Thank you for coming. This is Haughty by Nature. This is technically our 12th recording, and I think this will be close to number 20 episode. So, Jeffrey O'Brien, thanks for joining us. Lawyer extraordinaire.
Thanks for having me.
If you've listened to radio or podcasts from the Twin Cities, you've very likely heard you, right?
Yeah, I get around.
So a little bit about yourself then for the listeners?
Sure. I'm an attorney with the Minneapolis firm Chestnut Cambrone. I'm a business and real estate attorney, so I do the transactional stuff. You know, everything from, you know, forming companies and trademarks, some private security stuff, real estate deals. But what everybody tends to know me for is basically two things. I work with a lot of guys that make booze, a lot of guys and gals that make booze, breweries, distilleries, cideries. And I represent a lot of retired athletes in their business endeavors and nonprofit endeavors.
Any crossover there between those two worlds?
Not yet. Although when I get some of my athlete guys that are from out of town come into town, they've been known to like, I take them to Day Block Brewing, which is one of my clients. They've been known to imbibe in the bacon flight.
Oh, the bacon flight there is out of this world,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's
amazing.
Got some
honey in one.
I haven't been there for a while, so I haven't, you know, they change it up every once in a while, so I got to get back there.
Oh, you know, okay, so I didn't know. I thought they had a standard.
They don't change it as much as they used to, but they do, you know, they will occasionally rotate them. So, like, one time it'll be like, I remember one time when it was like a chocolate dipped, rolled in peanut, or in potato chip crumbles, and then another time it was the, you know, cumin rubbed in chimichurri sauce, and brat rubbed in
it moved.
Beer cheese, so, yeah. So,
little delayed reaction there from Jeffrey O'Brien.
Yeah.
So
it's an ingenious idea marketing wise. You know, you got a brewery, you got flights, so they put, you know, three different kinds of bacon and three different kinds of dipping sauce.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So, Jeffrey, one thing I noticed about you, and I mean, we've been friends in social media circles for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Couldn't possibly tell you how that came to be, but
it just happens. I'm the same way. It's like, how do we meet?
Right. And as we were leading up to our time here tonight, I was like, and Brandon and I kind of talked a little bit about this. Like, is Jeffrey a, you know, a liberty person? Is he kind of, where does he fit? And then I kind of started doing some investigating. I would put you, broadly speaking, you're a friend of liberty, I would say.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I always joke, I'm a single issue voter. I believe that taxation is theft and who's taking the least of my money. So, I tend to go along the lines of who is most likely to get elected and actually cut my taxes. So this year I've been griping up until now, I said, you know, if I'm going to throw the lever for an R for the White House, I expect by July 1st that I've got a tax cut. So, epic fail. So, I'm happy that they're coming around now.
Okay, hold on for a second. So, I'm going to get up and go to the wall where all the books are and pull the middle one out, and you get to actually come into the real chambers now. You pass the test. Like,
you're in. Yeah. And unfortunately, the listeners can't see what I'm looking at, but it is a magnificent, I would put vintage on this tie,
yes,
of about 1984.
No, it's about 1997, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
I'm just thinking of the golden age, back when George Shultz, the Secretary of State, on the Reagan administration, would go on Meet the Press wearing a goddamn Adam Smith tie.
Yep.
That was an administration we could be proud of.
Even if
it was only in theory.
No, I picked mine up. I spent one summer between college and law school in D.C. I was working for, it was actually former senator then, Dave Durenberger. Because I've been at St. Thomas. He was the faculty advisor to our college Republicans, and I begged him for a job for the summer so I could go. You know, I had a chance to go out to Washington before I went back to law school, and was out, took in as many Leadership Institute classes as I could, and, you know,
you go.
Picked up the tie along the way. So, yeah, nice. 20 years old.
It's a haughty tie. It really is hot. It's epic vintage. There's just a lot of good stuff going on there that probably means more to me as the old guy in the room. I probably get more from it than these guys do because I'm old enough to remember when Adam Smith ties, who would be so audacious as to put the father of the free market on their tie. Like, that was fairly audacious in 1981, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. So getting back to kind of some of what you do, especially in light of what you just said about being this guy who understands the principles of liberty, and you went to the Institute and all that stuff, and yet you work in this marketplace. I'm talking about especially the liquor business, that is you know, you could only say in the context or maybe in, with the backdrop of prohibition, it could be deemed a market. I mean, really, I mean, it's regulated more than almost anything.
Yeah, it's probably the one of the most regulated industries, and it is the laws we have. Everybody talks. I get a laugh when they say that, you know, they celebrate the day that, you know, the anniversary of prohibition's repeal. I'm like, not really. if you know about it, the fingers are all still here.
Right.
That the liquor laws in this country, and particularly this state, are some of the most antithetical to liberty that there are.
Right. Well, and that's what I mean by only with the backdrop of prohibition could you deem what we have now as
right.
anything, you know, resembling a free market. But like I said, as a liberty guy, you've got to be, it almost has to be drive you crazy at times to, you know, being someone who's advocating. And I know how I am especially when it came to things like Sunday sales, which is a real simple concept compared to many of the things you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard to even connect with people who didn't understand where I was coming from, how it was real common sense for me. So what's it like, especially given your perspective, how do you deal with the frustration of that?
Especially from quote-unquote conservatives, right, and Republicans who it shouldn't take much to get them to Sunday sales.
Yeah.
But for years and years and years, it has taken a lot to get people over there.
Yeah, yeah. They always were, you know, kind of seduced by this whole idea of the mom-and-pop mm-hmm. business, the liquor store or the bar or whatever it was, and trying to explain that, no, that's not the issue. And I think it was good friend Walter Hudson, when he testified about it, said this, told the Republicans, this is like the fundamental liberty issue. If you can't mm-hmm. get past this, then we're sunk on all the others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
I mean, the idea of letting giving a business the choice of whether or not to be open on a particular day of the week.
Arbitrary day of the
right.
week.
Yeah.
Right? Relatively.
Right. Yeah.
Like, if you really think government should be involved with this, then there's, why don't we just fold up tent and go?
Right.
And you're not, exactly. you're not conservative.
Exactly.
Well, and that was always Walter's point.
And I think part of what finally pushed it, I think, as we got, you know, we're talking here about, the craft beverage industry. I think as we got more elected officials in on both sides that were more of the, what I call the craft friendly crowd, then that's what pushed it over the cliff. I think that it was the boom in the industry, the consumers that like craft beer, craft spirits. I think it was ultimately them that drove this over. Like, this is ridiculous. This is nonsense. We need to move past this and repeal it. And eventually just there was enough forward momentum where you even got some of the older legislators that said, it's only a matter of time. Let's just pass it and get on to something
right.
else.
Right.
Let me test your commitment to liberty because haughty by nature is not afraid to go there.
Okay.
So you are,
he said taxation is theft once, right? So that's a good play to throw the red meat out.
Check.
There's no greater champion in the Twin Cities, the state, probably the upper Midwest, that the adult beverage industry has than Jeffrey O'Brien. So I get that, man, and you're legit for that very
mm-hmm.
reason.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another industry that's growing at geometric rate, and that's the recreational marijuana
mm-hmm.
movement.
I was going to go there.
As a representative or a friend of the liquor movement, do you fear that? Would you see that as competition or as just a broadening of all liberty?
No. In fact, my work in this industry has actually changed my position on that issue too. I think that if you remember this little history lesson, and we're talking, you know, about some of the, we're talking later about the tax stuff, you know, for a long time, our federal government was funded through the excise tax on alcohol. At the same time we got the two rail shot with prohibition is when they put the income tax in place. That was the substitute to fund the government because they were no longer going to be able to get money from the liquor manufacturers. So if you look at what we went through with alcohol and prohibition, I think there's a strong case to be made to just legalize marijuana and put an excise tax on it. And leave it at that. I think that we don't even be talking about 25% to 30% income tax rates. We can talk about, you know, 5, 10, 15 or getting rid of the damn thing.
Well, the three guys over here are going to be against any tax, but we totally get
that's progress.
I'm just saying there is legal precedent for how you would bring it in, legalize it, and
sure.
You know, and
to that point, what are the differences then between the repealing the prohibitions on alcohol over the last how many decades, right? Mm-hmm. And the repealing the current prohibition on marijuana. What are the differences in those two industries? Or is there anything different besides the cultural aspect and acceptance?
I think that, you know, a lot of what liquor regulation started out as it was public safety issues. It has mutated into naked self-interest. You know, I'll be on the phone with the folks from the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, and they'll say, this issue we're dealing with here, this isn't a public safety issue. Okay, but you got a retailer over here whose ox is going to get gored, or a wholesaler, and that's why the law is the way the law is. I think that public safety argument is probably the one that's, you know, that still has to be overcome when it comes to recreational marijuana. I think the difference is you don't have, maybe, but I guess it's another similarity. You know, you hear some of the, you know, the, when you get to medical marijuana and some of the stories of some of the folks have been able to, you know, alleviate either pain or suffering or have other medical issues, you know, cured through it. You've got the special interest group out there being big pharmaceutical. You know, they're the wholesalers and the retailers in this fight, and they don't want any alternatives because they make a lot of money the way the system is now.
That's scary. I'm scared about that.
Yeah.
In terms of barriers to legalizing marijuana, or decriminalizing at the very least, that big pharma is much scarier than liquor wholesalers. Yeah. To me.
Well, I mean, big pharma, they, you know, you get into things like homeopathic medicine, essential oils, all of these things that the FDA, you know, clamps down on.
That's true liberty things.
That's at the behest of big pharmaceutical.
Guys, speaking of, what's the word we just used here? The essential oils, right?
Mm-hmm.
Haughty is really happy to welcome a new member of the Haughty by Nature sponsor quiver, if you will. Hygieia Aromatics is a great store for the very kind of things we're talking about, right? Like here, I've got one at the table here, right? So you put these in a what's a diffuser, right?
Yep.
Or you do what I like to do, which is this.
Chug it.
Also, chug it. Oh, yeah. We also would have accepted chug it.
Yeah.
So I have my Coke Zero here, and I drop just a couple drops in here, and I've got a lemon, like a legitimate, like lemon Coke from out of 1954 at the soda fountain. And the nice thing about these oils is they come from lemon and orange cold pressed oils that are from pesticide free orchards in Italy. So if being clean, you know, free of pesticides is important to you, this would definitely be the place that you'd want to get some of these essential oils. So you can order online, or you can go, they have a store through the holidays at Ridgedale. So by the time this airs, unfortunately that will have transpired, but fantastic kiosk out there, and they do the bulk of their business via e-commerce. So Haughty's, these oils are an absolute game changer. Get yours today at aromatichealthcare.com. That's aromatic, just like it sounds, healthcare.com.
Very nice. Very nice. So what's the next step then, Jeffrey, in terms of the liquor legislation and what's on the forefront of the liquor industry, the small craft breweries? Where are they going legislatively and politically?
Well, it's going to be some interesting times. You know, there's a lot of fights to come. Part of the problem is the statute that authorizes, you know, the licensing statute that says what you can and can't do. It's very sparse and very vague. And in the way it's interpreted, you know, we go to law school and we learn that the way that you interpret a statute is if the statute doesn't say that you can't do it, that means that you can do it.
Right, sure.
With liquor law, it's the opposite. If the statute doesn't say that you can do it, it means that you can't do it. And part of our job as lawyers is finding out where the Department of Alcohol, the Division of Alcohol Gambling Enforcement, how far they're going to let us take something that's, you know, before they say, no, you can't. And, you know, I'll give you an example. You've got a lot of these breweries in town that are growing, just like any other business. They want to have, you know, maybe multiple locations. But when they passed the taproom law about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that really led to the big boom in the industry, they said you can only have one. And they said one because, of course, they were trying to placate the bar owners and that, you know, saw these guys as competition, right? So the department will take the position that even if you've got a brewery that has a license, this is kind of insane. If you have a license in another state, and you have a tap room there, they say, well, the statute doesn't say in Minnesota, so you can only have one. So if you have one there, you can't have one here.
But how
so
would that it's even be relevant?
Yeah,
I mean, like,
yeah, or if you so if we want to expand, have a second location, maybe have additional jobs, additional tax revenue. Nope.
Well, it really comes
you can only have one tap room
from the discretion of the bureaucrats at that level, right? I mean, it's rulemaking.
Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, it's sort of the inverse of the entire
and the position has changed
system that we live in, right? I mean, it's the inverse of enumerated powers. You know, it just gives the government infinite power, almost. You know,
whatever they claim for themselves,
to say, well, that is
right.
You know.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's. I mean, it's. I'm fortunate to have built up relationships with the folks that are making these decisions, so I can, you know, get some answers from them, and understand what they're doing. But at the same time, it's frustrating to have that much not codified.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have an absolute say, no, this is the way it is.
So one way around the Sunday sales law before it was repealed, thankfully, this year, that I always dreamed of doing was reading the law. It said you can't sell alcohol or liquor, and you know much better than I do, on Sunday. Mm-hmm. It didn't say you can't be open.
Mm-hmm.
So I always dreamed, we were working with the Republican Liberty Caucus in Liberty, Minnesota, when we were fighting for Sunday sales. Could we convince a liquor store to be open on Sunday, sell root beer, sell water, sell whatever, everything except alcohol? Would that legally be permissible? Obviously, I'm sure they wag a finger and threaten
you. We
and...
tried that with the breweries, because remember the progression of how we got to Sunday sales. You know, Sunday sales was for a long time the red herring that got a lot of these reforms through, because they would, you know, you get the other other tiers, you know, the of manufacturing, wholesale, retail, you get the other tiers to agree to whatever the change was, and they were doing to kick the can down the road, so they're trying to light a backfire to stay away from Sunday sales. So gotcha, you get the tap room, then it's the cocktail room, then it's the tap rooms can be open on Sundays. Well, now we can sell growlers on Sundays, and you know, all these, you know, all these different things, and it finally grew to the point where it was okay, fine, liquor stores can be open on Sunday. But there was that one session where the Teamsters were coming to the table. The Teamsters were rolled out as the patsy that year to try to kill it, and they said that if the breweries were allowed to sell growlers on Sundays, that somehow that would allow them to open up their they would be able to reopen their collective bargaining agreements with the distributors.
That's it.
And then it would be all just chaos, right?
Was that the 2014 session?
That was 2014. Because the interesting thing was they came back the next
session. Your valedictory session, wasn't it?
That was my first year in the Senate.
Because then they came back the next year and said, and they immediately rolled over and said they had no issue with it. And I'm like, well... Yeah. What was the cause of the epiphany? And we never did see the damn contracts that they claimed it would have to, that this would all, you know, these would, that would just be torn asunder if this was enacted. So anyway, so I had a few clients that suggested, what if we sold the growler on like online, you know, you could purchase it via website or buy it on Saturday or come in earlier during the week and then just pick it up on Sundays. Mm-hmm. And they ran that one past the state and they said, nope, if we look at the sales when it leaves the premises. Nothing that's written down.
Right,
to say
of course.
That.
Right,
that's,
right.
Just
yeah.
That's just there.
But could you, in theory, not that it'd be worth it, could you fight that in the court system? Say, it's not written down. How can we possibly follow a rule that's not written down?
I suppose you could try. It's just that you
wouldn't be worth
it. You know, you're again, it's not cheap to fight against the government.
Sure. Right.
So, Jeffrey, I have to ask you a question. So, like the three of us over here, you're just a guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet you've somehow, I can't help but notice that you've built this amazing online brand and in-person brand. You are the authority on multiple venues. You have a website. You recently managed to find yourself in the middle of the imbroglio between Modest Brewing. Am I saying it correctly?
Modest. Yep.
And Anheuser-Busch.
You're pronouncing it the Bud Light way.
How are you? Like, how did this guy become this, you know, how did you carve out? Take us how you carved out your spot in the world.
Sure. I always joke about how I just kind of stumbled into this brewery thing. You know, I was, when I started practicing, I was admitted to practice in Minnesota in 2000. And, you know, the first 5-6 years, you're a grinder, you're working on everybody else's clients. And at some point, you know, started to make an effort to develop my own book, because that's really how you have financial security in my industry, is to have your own book of clients and have them be portable.
Yep.
And I really focused on working. I was, you know, in my 30s at the time. I started working with a lot of startup businesses, you know, emerging, brand new, you know, pre-launch companies. A lot of them are still clients today, all these years later, which is pretty cool. But at some point along the way, roughly about 10 years or so ago, I started working with a brewery, and they were in a world of hurt. The original owner had pledged his house on a second mortgage as part of his loan. They were in default on their loan. He was going to lose his house. They basically needed new ownership. They needed to overhaul the whole thing. We worked through our networks to find someone to basically buy it. Kept the original owner on as the brewer for a period of time, and then when you have a change of ownership like that in an industry that's in the alcohol industry, you have to go back to square one. You have to submit applications for amended licenses with the feds, with the state. You know, you have to do all these things. So we basically learned everything we wanted to know about the legal end of a brewery. And there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of moving parts. You're forming your company. You have your buy-sell rights with your other partners. You have, you know, in some cases, you're raising money. So you have securities laws, state and federal, to comply with. You have trademarks because, you know, there's like 6,000 breweries in this country now, and everybody's, you know, we're using up all the names to the point where you're just going to start numbering these breweries if we get it anymore. You have the regulatory compliance. You have the real estate piece. There's so many different pieces. And then when they get open, then you have employment issues and distribution and all this stuff. And it's like, well, this is kind of interesting stuff. There's a lot of moving parts here. This could be kind of lucrative. And so I had always been one that was kind of trying to do a lot of business development marketing, a lot of content marketing. And I was just starting up a blog about the same time when this boom was kind of taking off.
Which was when? Give us again.
2009, 2010.
Yep.
And I said, let's go and get more. This is fun. And so I was starting to blog right around the time that the Surly bill was going through at the Capitol. And that's how I met Andrew Schmidt,
mm-hmm.
who went long before the Sunday sales fight. Schmidt, he had his Minnesota Beer Activist, was just kind of more of a, you know, a consumer review type organization. I found out later he was just holding his powder until after the taproom fight. And that's when he brought forth the Sunday sales thing. I met him and some other key people, and, you know, one grew to two grew to four, and it just kept growing. Dangerous Man, who we're drinking here tonight, their Russian Imperial Stout in Laphroaig Scotch barrels.
Jeez.
Dangerous,
thanks for bringing that for us.
I'm glad you like it.
Great.
Dangerous Man has been my client since their beginning. They were in my office, it was like two firms ago when I first met them. And so, you know, some of these guys like that, Dangerous Man, Insight, Modest, I've been with them since the beginning. Tattersall, the distillery. So it branched out to when the distilleries came out, because that was one of the outgrowths of the taproom law is not, you know, you have the breweries doing taprooms, but the permit fee for a distillery in Minnesota used to be $30,000. And that's why 45th Parallel is sitting over in Wisconsin, because they weren't paying $30,000 to start a distillery. So as part of the same bill that brought in the taproom law created the definition of a micro distillery and put that permit fee at $1,000. And now you have a distilling industry in Minnesota.
So you and I, Jeffrey, are big fans of Tattersall.
Yep.
And you just mentioned Tattersall. If
you also brought Tattersall gin to us.
Just a beautiful bottle, and it's a great spirit. I'm having it just on the rocks right now, just straight, and it's absolutely impeccable. I'm at Tattersall probably every 2 to 3 Fridays, right? I mean, I just love that place. Mm-hmm. I love the vibe.
Yep.
I actually have this personal ambition in 2018 to take pictures of all the chandeliers in town.
Yep.
And they would be like, they could easily be on the cover.
It's a gorgeous
great retail space.
Yeah. I'm excited. You know, Tattersall has been at the forefront of, I say they're like the Surly of distilleries from Minnesota. And they established their brand by, you know, everybody was putting out gin and vodka, you know, they came out with things like Aquavit, or they had a sour cherry liqueur, or the cranberry liqueur, or the Fernet. And they did all these liqueurs. And it really, I think, really kicked it up a notch. They're they're distributed in like 11 states now. My wife was just out in Utah.
Did not know that.
Getting back to the essential oils, my wife's a Young Living distributor, so she was out in Utah 2 weekends
ago. Start for the competition, Dad.
you gotta have your sponsor, gotta keep your sponsors happy. So she was out in Utah two weekends ago. Nah, it's fine. And she was at they're at the nice little resort, and they were at the lounge, and my wife asked if they had Tattersall vodka. And they didn't have it that time. He said, yeah, but I've had it. We've had it here before. So we're out in Utah, just outside of Salt Lake City.
That's awesome.
And we've got Tattersall spirits. You know, people know what Tattersall is. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
I think that's where we should have the Hottie by Nature holiday party, by the way.
Utah, perfect place for Hottie by Nature, Utah.
What I like about them is, you know, they're purists. You know, they with you know the whiskeys. You go there if you're gonna have a whiskey drink. Yes, they did the thing of, you know, everybody knows about the distillery in Indiana, which makes all the whiskey, and you bring it and bring it in. Mm-hmm. They only serve that in cocktails in their cocktail room for now. They have been aging their whiskey the real way, not through some artificial means or something like this. Like a few of them in town have done. They do it the old fashioned way. And it's funny, I was with my partner here this summer, and they had just taken a batch off the stills. They hadn't even put it in barrels yet. Still warm. And he said, do you want to try it?
Oh, wow.
And we're like, yeah.
Trick question. So I've got a question. So you talked about the micro distillery and have a distillery room, that whole concept. Mm-hmm. I literally in my mind never even conceived of that idea before I heard that it was a thing, like that there was an establishment actually doing those things.
Mm-hmm.
So as a layperson, an outsider, what are some other things that we should be doing but can't because of the regulatory framework around alcohol?
That's a good question. You take an example like the distillery. So you go to Tattersall. The distilleries are allowed to sell one 375 milliliter bottle per customer per day. So that the bottle that Gary's got here, it's a 750 milliliter. They can't sell those out of their cocktail room.
Okay.
Those have to go to the liquor stores. Why?
Right.
Because Johnson Brothers has Sam Kaplan lobbying for them.
They don't like direct to customer
right, right.
sales.
So they say you can have one 375 per customer per day, but you also have to make anything that you sell in the cocktail room available to wholesalers if they want it. So there's no cocktail room exclusives.
Mm-hmm.
So they're behind the times in terms of what the rights they have vis-a-vis the breweries. They have far less rights. So you can only buy one small bottle per trip. Which makes holiday gift shopping interesting when you can only buy one bottle and have to come back the next day.
Mm-hmm.
The other issues would be if you they have no self distribution. I mean, they have no self distribution. They have to go through a distributor. Okay, so you're going to pay higher prices because it's going through the distributors. And I always use the example. There's a brewery distillery out in Wayzata called Wayzata Brew Works. They're in the old Wayzata Boat Works building. They're right down the hall. They're literally 50 feet down the hall from Six Smith Restaurant, if you guys are familiar with Six Smith. So they do both brewing and distilling, because you can do that. You just have to have them in two separate things. Now, one thing is they can't serve their beer and their spirits and their on site. They have to pick one or the other. Again, that was the bars getting their way.
Right.
No competition, one or the other. So you can't. So they choose to sell their beer at their tap room. Spirits have to go out. So you can go down 50 feet down the hall to Six Smith and you can order a cocktail with their spirits, but you can't order it at their own location. Here's the best part, though. Because they can't self-distribute, they can't walk the case of booze down the hall 50 feet to Six Smith. They have to hire a distributor who will pick it up.
A licensed distributor.
Yes.
Not just some guy.
A licensed distributor who will pick it up, bring it down the hall, and sometime in that 50 feet, the price goes up 30%.
Wow, and that guy just sits in that hallway.
Yeah, it's you know that's the reason that we have a lot of the laws the way they are is because the wholesalers make a lot of money in the current system and they pay a lot to maintain the current system as best as they can.
Right,
and they definitely have their thumb down on the manufacturers. I mean, we didn't have a manufacturing here in here for a long time. We had, you know, we have a brewery here and there. You have Summit here that's been here for 30 years, but you didn't have this proliferation of manufacturers on all fronts. So now they're, you know, they're here. They're starting to get more politically sophisticated, and you know they're having some success over at the Capitol. They got snubbed this last year because they pushed. Trying to push the you know, we have caps as to, you know, you can't get a growler at Surly because Surly is above the 20,000 barrel production limit where you can't you can't sell growlers anymore.
I'm sorry, but there's so many references and just nomenclature that you're using that if you just replaced the word government or law with like mob or cartel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it would just, you know, they pushed them out and they've shut them down. And
I always,
you gotta hire some guy.
They gotta hire some guy to walk it down the thing because
Vinny needs his
right, and he needs his 30,
That's the wholesalers. I when I do my presentations, I have a slide of the mob in the during Prohibition and all the broken bottles and they got the Tommy guns. I said the only difference between now and then is they don't have as many guns. Right. You know, they're still the Huns, basically. I was at every year we do, there's a craft brewers conference around the country. The Brewers Association, which is like the national trade group, does this. And I was there a couple years ago. It was out in Portland and they had a paneler talking about this whole, they call it the three tier system, right? This is how, we had the tied houses before Prohibition and, the breweries were, bringing about, ill repute on everybody by, serving the salty sandwiches and then giving them beer.
You're looking at some of them. Huh? Ill repute.
And so this system where they, you have to have the middleman, right? The wholesaler, they have to take it and sell it to the retailer. You can't have the suppliers abusing the retailers or anything like that, making them sell this or that. Or the other thing. You got to have this middleman. So that's, there was a panel discussion about this three tier system and whether or not with the craft beer revolution, if there was some needs for changes. And they had one of the panelists was an attorney and lobbyist for the Kansas beer wholesalers. And he flat out said, well, we like it the way it is because we make a lot of money this way. It works for us. And it was at one point, though, and I have a recording somewhere of it. I saved it because I always like to show everybody what we're up against opposition-wise. He was talking about the role of the wholesaler, and he, honest to God, likened the wholesalers to Christ spreading the gospel. And they said, did you seriously? And the moderator just said, did you seriously just compare wholesalers to Christ?
What was his logic or lack thereof?
They were the middleman, they were like bringing the product to the masses or something. And it's like,
they're the people person. They have people skills.
Yeah, pretty much.
What do you do?
Well, they're the ones, even though it's who they've been trucking out, the Teamsters or the retailers or all these liquor stores over the years, they're really the ones that didn't want Sunday sales.
Because, the wholesalers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because there's this belief that, this was going to be the slippery slope to convenience stores and grocery stores being able to sell full strength liquor, right? And I understand there might be some movement towards trying, they might try to get that this year. That's going to be another long fight.
Mm-hmm. Could you imagine, though? I mean, what would happen to our communities?
I know, because Wisconsin's just falling off the face of the earth, all those convenience stores and grocery stores that sell alcohol.
Michigan,
just,
you can buy 24/7 at grocery stores and full liquor. Everything
true
is
hashtag true liberty.
It's anarchy. It's anarchy. Yeah.
I will tell you one story. One side note: I was in my in-laws live in Green Bay. My wife is from Wisconsin.
Condolences.
And we're at the Festival of Foods in Green Bay, and this is how they had the liquor store laid out. They had one whole wall, and you've probably seen this when you go there. And it's
the grocery store?
No, just any liquor store in Wisconsin. Okay,
yeah, so I get in town and I get out of town.
Okay, all right. Well, so this place they had your Miller products, they had New Glarus, they had all the Wisconsin beer in like one wall of the store, right?
Yeah.
Then on the other side, one of the other wall, they had Summit, Grain Belt, some other shells. They had like some other shells brands, Guinness, Harp, Corona, Red Stripe,
they
honest to God, had a sign above the whole thing, world beer. So if you weren't Wisconsin, you weren't from America.
Yeah.
It was just world beer.
We need a wall between Wisconsin and Minnesota, right? We need to make Wisconsin pay for it, too.
There you go.
Yeah. Except I'm Ascania. Yeah, right, so.
They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever, and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be.